There's a way to make an entrance.
My destiny.
It was now a conspiracy of witches.
Download Veely today.
In February 2003, police were trying to track down a vicious attacker who was targeting young, blonde women.
He would run up behind them and hit them on the head, often with a hammer, repeatedly, and then run back to his car and disappear into the darkness.
One woman, Marcia McDonnell, had died from her injuries. And by August 2004, the assailant had claimed a second victim, Amélie Delagrange.
He is a predator. He's stalking his prey. He's staking them out. And he's very organised and he's very planned, and that makes him incredibly dangerous.
The killer was a man named Levi Belfield. Even after his incarceration in 2008, he was linked with the shocking murder of a 13-year-old schoolgirl.
I hate it when people refer to him as an animal, because animals don't behave like that. They kill to survive, not for fun and pleasure. He was born evil. He is pure, pure evil.
Levi Belfield had cemented his place as one of the world's most evil killers. Levi Belfield is one of the most notorious British killers in recent memory. He was responsible for the brutal murders of two young women and the attempted murder of another across an 18-month period between 2003 and 2004. While serving time in prison, he was again found guilty in 2011 of one of the highest-profile cases of the 21st century. The murder of schoolgirl Millie Dowler, a crime that had gone unsolved for almost a decade.
They've waited 9 years and been put through the trauma of this court case. They linked arms as the jury foreman pronounced Levi Belfield guilty of murder.
But this killer's shocking story began over 40 years before. Levi Belfield was born into a Romani gypsy family in Isleworth, West London, on the 17th of May 1968. He was one of five children. Age 10, Belfield lost his father to leukemia, and as a result, he formed a very close bond with his mother.
Belfield was very much a mother's boy, much beloved of his mother. It was a close-knit family. Brought up in West London, in what was effectively once a huge community of travellers, and was groomed to thinking from the very early days that he was very special, that there was something particular about him. His mother encouraged him in that view.
I think during his childhood he was a bit of a tearaway. He was a young lad who wanted to do what he wanted to do and not much stood in his way. So he was often kind of larking around and getting into a bit of trouble at school, but nothing completely out of the ordinary.
By the time Belfield was 13, he'd had his first brush with the law and was arrested for burglary in 1981. It would not be the last time he was in trouble with the police.
I believe Belfield occupied what you might describe as the halo of Levi Belfield. I am greater than anything. He was above the law, above suspicion, operated entirely under his own steam, in his own way, at his own time.
In 1989, 21-year-old Belfield set up home with a girlfriend. They went on to have four children together.
He could literally charm the birds off the trees. This is a 19 and a half, 20 stone man with a huge neck, almost occupying his entire shoulders. He wasn't an attractive man, but my goodness me, he had the gift of the gab, and he didn't half use it to his advantage, particularly when it came to girls.
Another woman who fell under Belfield's spell and would go on to have two children with him was his common law wife, Jo Collings.
I first met him when I was about 17, 18, because we all used to go to a place in Twickenham called Sellers. But I kind of knew him a little bit before then, because where I used to keep my horses, he used to drink at the pub just round the corner, and his mum lived just down the road. Everyone knew him. He was always, you know, everyone wanted to be around him. He was like the sort of the fun person to be with, you know, always loud.
But Belfield was not a man of morals and often had extramarital affairs. His job as a nightclub doorman helped him meet girls.
That way he had access to any number of young women, all of whom, how can put it politely, were not backward in coming forward. They were out for a good time, and Belfield was out to help them have one.
He had the talk, you know, the cuteness, and like I said, I mean, back in the day, he was good looking. You know, he always had the nice car, always had nice clothes, and, you know, he could get the women.
But his charming persona soon disappeared once he'd got what he wanted.
In adulthood, Levi Belfield became a man that women should be quite fearful of. He's somebody who was really entitled. He had a real sense that women were there to serve his needs, and when they didn't comply with his expectations, he would turn violent and very nasty.
The abuse started 5-6 months after we got together. Might not even have been that long, just with the odd slap and dig, and then he'd be really sorry, and it's because he said he'd never felt this way about anyone. I'd found out I was pregnant as well. So it was more, he was trying to make out that, you know, he really cared and everything else. But, I mean, he was still seeing the one he was with before me at the time. Some of the abuse, he'd punch you, bite you, kick you, burn you cigarettes, make you sleep naked on the floor, spit at you. You couldn't go to the toilet unless he was sat on the bath beside you. All sorts of things.
Despite Belfield's violent behaviour towards the women in his life, they rarely reported him to the police for fear of what he might do to them.
Time after time in Belfield's career, the women in his life could have pursued cases against him for violent attack, and yet persistently chose not to, and that pays some tribute to his extraordinary charisma.
I was the only one that had an injunction put on him, and within half an hour of him being served, it was torn up in an envelope through my front door, and he'd written on the envelope, "Now I'm going to kill you."
By 2002, Belfield had fathered 11 children with 5 different women. He'd started a new job, clamping cars, and was living in the leafy Surrey town of Walton-on-Thames. On March the 21st, 2002, 13-year-old schoolgirl Amanda Dowler, known affectionately as Millie, went missing from her home. Journalist Martin Brunt remembers that day very well.
She was on her way home. She got off the train, was going to walk the half mile or so back to her home. She was in her school uniform, very identifiable. This was daylight, busy time of the afternoon, lots of people around, but nobody saw anything.
Millie had phoned her father to say she was heading home, but never arrived.
She seemed to have disappeared into thin air. There was CCTV footage of her getting off the train at Walton Station. Some very blurred images of cars and the odd person in the street where she was headed home, but nothing more than that. And it became clear very early on that police were really struggling to find what had happened to her.
The last sighting of Millie Dowler was on Station Avenue in Walton, just 50 yards from the home of Levi Belfield.
The search has taken in stretches of water, including the River Mole, but police have been concentrating on ground near the busy station and interviewing commuters.
We have nothing that gives us any positive indication that she's gone off of her own volition. Equally, we have no positive information that she has been taken off the street and abducted. At this time, all of our lines of inquiry are open.
On September the 18th, 2002, 6 months after her disappearance, the body of Millie Dowler was found by a group of foragers amongst the trees of Yateley Heath Wood in Hampshire.
So, Millie was identified through dental records. She was known to be missing. Dental records were obtained, and then they were compared to the remains that were present, and sadly for her family, it confirmed that that's who it was.
It was clear to forensic ecologist Professor Patricia Wiltshire that Millie's body had been in the woods ever since she disappeared.
I was able to tell the police how long each bone had been there and whether, how long ago it had been moved, because the bones were moved around by animals, you see. There was no doubt in my mind, really, that she had been there since the early spring.
How Millie was killed remained a mystery.
The degree of change that the body goes through after death, particularly in the sort of timescales we're talking about with Millie Dowler, really hinders what the pathologist can see, what the pathologist can say. It doesn't mean that there's nothing we can see or say, but clearly the less we have to work with, the more difficult it is.
One likes to be objective, one likes not to think of the remains as a person, one likes to just look for the evidence and be yet you try to be objective. And then, of course, they take you into a scenario where you become fairly emotional. Well, you can't help it. It's an emotional sort of scenario. And then it comes a bit of a shock, really.
The police had no suspects and no forensic evidence. And just 5 months after the discovery of Millie Dowler's body, only a few miles from Walton-on-Thames, another young woman was murdered. At around midnight on the 3rd of February 2003 in Kingston, London, 19-year-old Marcia McDonald caught the bus home after a night out at the cinema with friends. It was the last time they would ever see her. Walking home, Marcia was attacked from behind less than 100 yards from her parents' front door. Colin Sutton was one of the lead detectives with the Metropolitan Police at the time.
Marcia was found on the street where she lived, 10 or 15 doors down from her parents' house. Local resident heard a noise, heard her whimpering, if you like, and called police, and she was found there with this terrible head wound, and she was taken to hospital and died 2 or 3 days afterwards. Marcia was killed with a single blow to the back of the head with a heavy implement.
Forensic evidence suggested the weapon used was most likely a hammer.
Hammers are effective striking tools, so it's no great surprise that you can cause very severe damage to a human skull with relatively little effort with an effective hammer. You'll often see lacerations, they're often curved to match the profile of the hammer, and you'll often see skull fractures. They're quite often depressed, so pushed inwards towards the brain, because the hammer is exerting its force so focally.
Nightfall, and detectives in Hampton still work on. But though they've searched tirelessly all day, they remain baffled as to who carried out this apparently random attack.
Often these things happen and are carried out by somebody the victim knows. In this case, I'm sure police looked at boyfriends, family members, but very quickly ruled out any kind of suspect like that. So it soon became obvious that this was a stranger murder, and those are very rare. So very soon, very quickly after Marcia's murder, people in the area became very concerned that there was a killer on the loose.
Subsequent investigations led police to a mentally unstable 16-year-old who wasn't competent enough to be charged or even interrogated about the incident.
And as a result, he was sectioned and was put into to some sort of institution compulsorily. And although he hadn't been charged with the offence, everybody kind of thought, well, it was him, and so we can put that offence to bed and you know, we've solved that, if you like.
But then investigators noticed a possible link to similar attacks that had happened in the area in the months before.
was another 16-year-old schoolgirl that she was thought at first to have slipped over in the snow and banged her head. And it was only then when Marsha was murdered that police looked at this occurrence some 2 months previously and realised that that could have been an assault as well. And they went back to this girl who'd been treated in hospital and were able to talk to the hospital staff and look at the description of her wounds and some photographs and conclude that the likelihood was that she too had been attacked but had survived. We found a couple of other offences as well. Again, young ladies had been attacked in the street and hit over the back of the head. And in both these cases, they'd survived.
However, none of these other victims were able to identify the attacker.
They just, you know, said I was walking along and the next thing I knew, I woke up in hospital some hours or some days later. So we didn't have any kind of clue or sighting that led us towards the suspect for it because they just simply couldn't remember it.
All of the attacks seemed to be totally unprovoked. Could they all have been committed by the same perpetrator, the man who murdered Marsha McDonald?
As everybody knows, most murders are committed by someone you know, whether it's a husband, wife, lover, jilted lover. It's comparatively rare for random attackers to kill.
Then, on the 28th of May 2004, 15 months after the murder of Marsha McDonald, 18-year-old student Kate Sheedy was heading home after a night out in Twickenham, West London, to celebrate the end of her A-levels. Just after midnight, she caught the bus to nearby Isleworth and began to walk the few hundred yards to her front door.
She's walking along the road and she's aware up ahead of her was a people carrier that was sitting parked with the engine running. And she said it was white and it was sinister, was the phrase that she used. She said it looked a bit sinister because it had blacked out windows and she just thought it was up to no good. She didn't like it. Some sort of sixth sense or whatever said to her, no, don't walk past that. So she crossed the road so that she'd be walking on the other side of the road when she walked past the people carrier. She heard this people carrier start up, accelerate, and it literally came across the road and simply ran into her, just ran her over. She ended up on the road between the front wheels and the back wheels of the people carrier. It then reversed, so the front wheels went over her body again and drove off.
Incredibly, Kate survived the frenzied and brutal attack.
To overrun a human body with a large vehicle like a people carrier can cause very severe injuries. You've got all the weight of that vehicle going through the tyres onto the body. If that's across the limbs, you're going to get fractures. If it's across the head injuries. Obviously, the chest and abdomen are very prone to injury from that pressure on it. And for somebody to be overrun twice and survive is very close to miraculous, and I suspect it's a compliment to the skill of the people who attempted to save her life.
She had terrible injuries. You know, she had every rib broken. She had her liver was in two and various sort of injuries that she was so brave and she overcame and she ended up going to university and you know, getting on with her life.
Although the attack on Kate Sheedy seemed very different to the murder of Marsha McDonald and all the other reported incidents, detectives still believe they could all be linked.
It's similar in its outcome and it's similar in the area where it took place and the age and the victim and what she looks like and all this sort of thing. It's just the weapon, substitute car for hammer, and it's the same. They ranged in age between sort of 16 and 32. They were all blonde or blondish and I guess all of them were well-dressed and were quite kind of sophisticated, looked quite well off rather than perhaps some of the other people in the street.
Someone who fitted that description perfectly was 22-year-old French exchange student Amélie Delagrange. And just 3 months after the attack on Kate Sheedy, Amélie was found dead. On the 19th of August 2004, 22-year-old French exchange student Amélie Delagrange caught the bus home to her rented flat in Twickenham. But she missed her stop.
It was a nice night in August, and she thought, oh, it's not very far, I'll walk. And You know, that was her fateful decision. Had she waited for the bus, she may well have been okay that night. At about 10:15, there's a young man walking around Twickenham Green, and there's a cricket pitch there, and he walked across the cricket pitch and found what he thought at first was just a bundle of rags or a bundle of clothes, but turned out to be Amelie, and she was lying there on the grass. Her shopping bag with her shopping in was next to her, and she had a single wound across the back of the head, was bleeding profusely. He thought she was still alive at that point, called for an ambulance. He ran to the shops on the north side of the green and alerted people to call police and ambulance. And she was taken to a hospital and died an hour or so later of this single wound, which had caused a, you know, catastrophic sort of fracture to her skull and a brain injury.
It appeared that Amelie had been killed by a blow to the head with a hammer, just like Marcia McDonald. Police were now certain the killings were more than just a coincidence.
We were conscious that there had been a number of similar attacks in the area over the preceding sort of 18 months or so. One of those was the murder of Marcia McDonald, and the other was the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. And as our investigation progressed looking at the Amelie murder, so we realised that we had to look at these previous offences as well.
Like all the attacks reported, there appeared no motive for the murder.
Absolutely no reason for it. None. Simply a random killing. The most difficult kind of killer to catch, incidentally, because there's no connection. There was no connection between Amelie de la Grange and Marcia McDonald. None. They didn't know each other. They weren't friends. There was no connection between those two and Kate Sheedy.
A second senseless murder in the same area meant the story was now front page news.
Suddenly, we had potentially a serial killer on the loose, not on some scuzzy council estate, but in leafy Twickenham and Hampton. And that really struck fear in the neighbourhood, and police were struggling to find an answer for a motive.
The media were very keen to ask us, is this a series? Are we dealing with a serial killer? Because those words have a particular sort of connotation and mean something. And because we couldn't link them formally by DNA or fingerprints, we couldn't really say that. So what we said was that we had a linked investigative series. And what that meant was these offences are so similar in MO and in their location and the profile of the victim that it would be a nonsense to investigate them with different teams.
Pressure to catch the killer was mounting.
Truth was that, without being too sort of dramatic or too sort of cliched, we knew while we were investigating it that if we didn't succeed, he was going to do another one. You know, there was a time element in this one.
But there was very little evidence for Colin and his team to work with, particularly in Amelie's case.
Nobody had seen anything. There was no CCTV covering there. She had a boyfriend. She had no other kind of contacts, really, in you know, no family or friends or life history in England. She'd not been here very long. And it had all the kind of characteristics of a completely random attack, and they're often the very hardest to investigate because not only do you not have the links to help you, but also they're quite often those murders that are pre-planned. And when people pre-plan murders, they tend to think about things like CCTV and their mobile phone data and all the other tricks and DNA and fingerprints and things. And all the things that we can use in most murder cases can be absent in pre-planned murders.
There was no DNA evidence at the scene of any of the attacks, but Amelie's mobile phone was missing. Police checked data to see when it was last located.
They were able, from the phone company, to get the information that her phone had switched off from the network, had been lost by the network, if you like, at Walton-on-Thames at a particular time. But this time was something like 8 or 9 minutes after she was found dying on Twickenham Green. And Walton-on-Thames is a considerable distance away, and it pointed to the bag with her phone in it having been taken away by somebody in a vehicle.
Detectives trawled through 2,000 hours of CCTV and eventually identified a white van at the scene, parked close to where Amelie was murdered. But there were over 25,000 similar vans registered in the UK, so the police weren't optimistic about finding the right one. But luck was on their side.
We had this file that was, the official name for it is the single suggestion file, I think, where people ring up and say, I've got an idea who might have committed that crime, it is, and give a name. And we had 129 people in this file, and every one of them had been suggested to us from a former wife or former girlfriend, or even a current wife or current girlfriend. And I termed it the Women Scorned file. So we thought, oh, we'll go and have a look through that and see if anybody in there had access to a white van, and we might be able to kind of shortcut the search that way.
The name Jo Collings surfaced. She'd come forward after the murders were reported and suggested her ex-partner, Levi Belfield, as a possible suspect.
I was technically with him in a relationship 3-4 years, but he ruled my life for 11 years, every day. He would drive past my house 5, 6, 10 times a day, constantly ring me. He would walk down the alleyway at the back of my house and he'd ring me and tell me what time I'd put the kettle on, what I was wearing, who was around my house, everything.
Jo told detectives Belfield had a white van for his wheel clamping business and that he had a violent nature with a particular hatred of blonde women. It was a pivotal moment in the case.
I'd always, at the back of my mind, because of how twisted and warped he is, you always think he could go that one step further. I mean, people say I'm as guilty as he is because I didn't come forward before, but there was never enough evidence or enough people willing to say, yes, actually, he did do this, he did do that, because so many people were scared of him.
We get the report we've had, which says my ex-partner, Levi Belfield, is a very violent man. He had got a hatred of women, particularly blondes. I found a magazine where he'd stabbed through all the photographs of blonde girls in it. He's very weird, and it's just the sort of thing he'd want to do. And he now works as a wheel clamper and uses a little white van to do it. So, oh, you know, that's exactly what we're looking for, somebody who's got a small white van. So let's try and progress that.
It was the ownership of that van that, in the end, led the police to Levi Belfield's door.
By joining the dots, Colin and his team could link Belfield to another vehicle, the car that ran Kate Sheedy down.
And one of the times that he was arrested was in May 2004, when he was arrested for kidnap, which was kidnapping the landlord of a pub near where he lived in West Drayton. And nothing happened about it, and the landlord in the end said, oh, no, it was just a prank that went wrong, don't worry about it, didn't want to press charges, no charges were brought. But the crucial thing was that that arrest took place, and that abduction took place indeed, in a vehicle, and that vehicle was a white Toyota Previa. Kate Sheedy had been attacked in Isleworth, not by being hit across the head, but by being run over by a large vehicle. And she said that this vehicle was something like a Ford Galaxy. Of course, that's exactly what a Toyota Previa is.
The white people carrier, that was actually on my drive about 2 weeks before he ran Kate Sheedy over with it, only because he asked me if he could leave it there for a couple of nights, and I begrudgingly said yes.
And he got somebody to go and do a check on the number plate of the Previa that Levi had been arrested in, and I remember her saying to me, Governor, I think we might have hit the jackpot, and said it was white. We now had somebody, Levi Belfield, who had the right kind of white van that was used at the time Amélie Delagrange was murdered, and the right type of vehicle at the time that Kate Sheedy was run over.
Belfield was now the prime suspect. At dawn on the 22nd of November 2004, police raided his West Drayton home.
In the attic is a naked Levi Belfield. He'd covered himself up in the hope that no one would find him. Well, they did, and indeed the sergeant got him down and duly handcuffed him.
Of course, he said to us, oh, I was only hiding because I thought it was a gang, I thought it was somebody after me. Well, it was somebody after you, Levi, but it was the murder squad.
At 8:30 this morning, police raided several homes in West Drayton. The one behind me, that of 36-year-old Levi Belfield and his common-law wife. The nightclub bouncer is currently being held at a West London police station.
Belfield was interrogated by detectives in relation to a long string of offences ranging from rape to grievous bodily harm. He refused to answer any questions, and at one point he even petulantly turned his back on investigators. He was remanded in custody for almost 16 months until the 2nd of March 2006, when he was formally charged with the murder of Amélie de Lagrange and the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. The murder of Marsha McDonald was added to his list of charges on May the 25th, 2006. Belfield's trial began at the Old Bailey on October the 12th, 2007. He pleaded not guilty on all counts.
Levi Belfield's trial for the murders of Amélie and Marsha was very long, very drawn out. He was an imposing figure in the dock, big, tall, but it was his manner throughout it that I think drew most attention. He looked very bored. He did give evidence. There were glimpses of the charm, in a way, when he was talking. There was a point where he was explaining how you can be a successful wheel clamper. I'm not suggesting he charmed the jury, but I think some of them might have found him captivating while he was talking in those terms. But he also had a very squeaky voice that, again, was at odds with this rather physically imposing man in the dock. Denied any of the charges, and you got the impression that he felt that he would be acquitted at the end of it.
But the circumstantial evidence weighed heavily against Belfield.
They found 20 or 30 sightings of this van, separate bits of CCTV, and that's when we built up the picture of this van circling Twickenham Green, effectively, and driving around for a period of something like 45 minutes before Amélie was murdered. Hunting, no other word for it. You know, it was cruising a very small area, looking for people to approach.
On February the 25th, 2008, Belfield was found guilty of the murders of Amélie de Lagrange and Marsha McDonald, as well as the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. Judge Mrs. Justice Rafferty sentenced Belfield to a whole life tariff. He was immediately sent to Woodhill Prison. He will never be released.
His modus operandi, according to the police, was that he got very angry if he approached a young woman that he was attracted to and felt rejected by them. And it is suggested that this is what happened in the case of the two women he killed.
So these women, they were disposable objects to him. They were part of his killing game, his sort of hobby, his leisure activity.
The day Belfield received his sentence, he was named as the chief suspect in a case that had shocked the nation and remained unsolved for 9 years. The murder of Millie Dowler.
There was a lot of circumstantial evidence, particularly the fact that he had been living close by, within a couple of hundred yards of the place where she disappeared. It was established that he had use of and had used on that day his partner's red car, which matched one that was found in CCTV of the scene. But then there was the evidence of his partner, who said that Levi Belfield had got up in the middle of the night of Millie's disappearance, and had made an excuse to go back to that flat. And when she later went to the flat, she discovered that the bedding had disappeared off their bed. And he said that the dog had fouled the bedspread and he'd had to burn it. Now, that was quite compelling evidence for the jury, and they were convinced that he was the killer.
On the 4th of March 2008, an ex-colleague of Belfield, Kelly Fry, told ITV News he confessed to murdering Millie back in 2002.
He pointed out a flat in Walton and said that he used to live there and that he'd lost £900 in rent that he'd already paid because he had to move out. And he said, oh, yeah, I also set fire to Emma's car. And I said, well, why would you set fire to your girlfriend's car? And he said, because I took the girl. That was his exact words. And immediately I just knew that he was on about Millie. If I for one minute thought that it was true, then I would have come forward a long, long time ago.
There was no forensic evidence. There was no smoking gun anywhere. They had to build a case with what people had been saying, with little facts, with phone evidence they had, with what CCTV they had, which wasn't particularly much. The whole thing came back to us knowing what Levi Belfield had done on the night that Millie Dowler was abducted.
Belfield had been questioned about Millie Dowler during the time he was on remand for his other crimes and had always replied, no comment. But one person was certain he'd murdered Millie, his ex-partner, Joe Collings.
He said that he'd never been to Yateley and he had no knowledge of the area. Well, out of all the photographs, and I don't know why, everything I had I threw away. And I found an envelope and it had two photographs in it, and it was two of me and him at Yateley, which is really bizarre. And I'm a great believer of everything happens for a reason, and I wasn't meant to throw those pictures out because they were needed. And of course they showed him in Yateley, so he knew where Millie was found. He knew exactly the lay of the land because we used to go there all the time.
On the 10th of May 2011, Levi Belfield, 3 years after his first trial, was once again in the dock at the Old Bailey, this time charged with the murder of Millie Dowler. Belfield pleaded not guilty and refused to give evidence in his defence.
It was Levi Belfield. It's a power and control thing for him, because only he has knowledge of the murders that he's committed. Only he knows exactly who his victims were, the full extent of the women that he perpetrated these crimes against. And it gives him a sense of power. He's in prison now, so what he's got control over is very limited. But one thing that he still can exercise power over is that knowledge. And as long as that's his, then he's in control.
Geoffrey Wonsell was in the courtroom during the trial.
What's striking about Belfield is that he wanted to put every witness through a real ordeal because he never once pleaded guilty. He wanted them all to suffer, and he particularly wanted the Dowler family to suffer. It was as though he were smirking to himself. Look what I'm putting you through. He sat there, absolutely silent throughout this fierce cross-examination, utterly justified. I'm not criticising at all, in fact. It was perfectly justified. Belfield made it happen. He made it happen by not pleading guilty, and he made it happen by instructing his own defence silk, his own barrister, to pursue the Dowlers to the full extent he was possible of. And it's very difficult to forgive Belfield for that. And he underlines just what a malicious, malign, evil man he is.
On June the 23rd, 2011, the jury found Levi Belfield guilty. Judge Mr. Justice Wilkie sentenced him to a further whole life tariff on top of the one he was already serving.
The fact that he is, as far as I know, the only convicted killer who's been given two whole life tariffs does make him unique. A judge in each case, the two judges, both felt that his crimes were so awful that he should be never given the chance of parole, that life will mean life for him. To be given two sentences like that is extraordinary. I suppose, in practical terms, it doesn't make any difference. Again, I suppose if he ever felt that he might try and challenge that, he's got to do it twice, and the chances of him ever being released are nil.
I think Levi Belfield will be enjoying the notoriety that comes along with being a double life sentenced prisoner, because I think there is a certain hierarchy in prison in terms of the nature of the offences that you've committed, the type of sentence that you have. And he will very much see himself as the upper echelons of the prison population.
In 2016, it was reported that Belfield had confessed to the murder of Millie Dowler, giving gruesome details of how he'd abused and killed her. But then, shortly after, he retracted the admission, causing the Dowler family untold grief.
He loves to manipulate, and he loved to manipulate the Dowler family, and they were his victims every bit as much as Millie was.
Well, basically what's going on when offenders like Levi Belfield admit to things or don't admit to things or retract things is that they are eliciting quite a lot of attention. They are keeping people interested in them. They are playing with people, because people like Levi Belfield, they are the puppet masters. They like pulling other people's strings. They like pushing their buttons and seeing what happens.
Levi Belfield is now serving time at Franklin Prison. He has converted to Islam and calls himself Yusuf Rahim.
Nothing would ever surprise me with Levi Belfield. I don't know what he's done. Only he knows what he's done. He would do anything if he thought there was an angle that made it the best thing for Levi Belfield to do for Levi Belfield. And he was ruthless, he was violent, he was sociopathic, I'm sure. So who knows what else he might have done.
He sees himself, and still sees himself to this day, as a powerful, charismatic, famous, now notorious figure whose place is guaranteed in the record books. It feeds his arrogance, it feeds his ego, and there's nothing that Belfield likes more than feeding his ego.
In letters written by Belfield from his cell to the makers of this programme, he claims that he has never confessed to any of his crimes and still maintains he is not guilty, saying, "I'm innocent of all my convictions. I've witnessed and done things I truly regret, but I'm no killer. My lifestyle led to my wrongful convictions. I blame no one but me. The real victims are the victims and families of these crimes. I am sincerely sad for their loss, but I am not a victim. My lifestyle put me here. My choice. My fault. But some of the people who know him better than others refuse to believe Belfield's protestations."
Levi, evil, all blends into one. I've always said it before, I hate it when people refer to him as an animal, because animals don't behave like that. They kill to survive, not for fun and pleasure. He was born evil. He is pure, pure evil.
Belfield is a psychopath. He deserves utterly to be in jail for the rest of his life. He's a preening, vain, manipulative, smart, deathly man. And if anyone deserves to be called evil, it's certainly Levi Belfield.
Despite Levi Belfield's claims of innocence, he has been convicted of three murders and one attempted murder. We may never know if there are other victims out there or not, but what we do know is that Belfield bludgeoned two women to death with a hammer, ran another over repeatedly in his car, and killed a 13-year-old girl who had her whole life in front of her. Yet Belfield has never offered any reason or remorse for his actions. He is, without doubt, one of the world's most evil killers.